You are listening to Money on the Left, a monthly interdisciplinary podcast that reclaims money's public powers for imaginative, intersectional politics, proudly presented in partnership with Monthly Review Online. I'm Billy Soss with Scott Ferguson. This month, we're joined once again by Benjamin Wilson, associate professor and recently minted chair of the Department of Economics at SUNY Cortland. This time out, we get into the nitty-gritty of what it's like to teach economics, with a capital E, from a heterodox MMT perspective. Shaped in a number of ways by our conversation with Larry Johnson last month. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, you really should. Our conversation with Ben explores using neoclassical textbooks in the heterodox classroom, the utility of classroom currencies for econ classes of all levels, the place of narrative and rhetoric in neoclassical theory, and so much more. If you're into pedagogy, you'll be super into this one. Thanks to Ben for joining us again, to Robert Rush for the graphic, and to Mike Lewis for the transcripts.
Benjamin Wilson, welcome back to Money on the Left.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So since you last joined us, I hear you've become the chair of the economics department at your university. Is that true? Are the rumors true?
The rumors are true. I took that role on with a tremendous amount of hesitancy, just because, I don't know, it's the rumors are true that it is a significantly greater amount of work. I'm glad that I'm doing it. I'm halfway through my second year, and it's looking like I'll probably take on a third year, just because at the end of my third, then we'll have enough people that have been tenured and gone on sabbatical and done things that we can go forward and elect a new chair and then have rotations of 2 to 3 years for each of us moving forward, which I think is a really exciting evolution in our department and really part of us getting, a series of new hires after retirements and sort of coalescing as a new team for, what will be hopefully the start of my second full decade at SUNY Cortland, which is a little bit mind-boggling to me.
So what's it like teaching economics at SUNY Cortland? I mean, as an outsider who knows just a little bit about economics and economics pedagogy in the United States, my impression is that most economics departments really suck. And that they teach some pretty horrible things and reproduce a culture of neoclassical economics that doesn't really encourage critical historical, social, political or ecological thought at all. And I have a sense that something different happens at SUNY Cortland in the economics department.
Yeah, it very much does. In terms of what goes on at other economics departments, I have a hard time saying because I graduate work was at UMKC, which is another super unique opportunity in space. And even as an undergraduate at the University of Kansas, which ended up being a pretty strongly orthodox department, my first professor at that university was very much more of a heterodox inclined political economist. And I really didn't appreciate how great that was until I started doing the PhD work there, and it was all models and maximization and all those things. And we've talked about that previously. So, at Cortland, we have a very pluralistic department. So hopefully this airs before we close our next application process for interviews, because we are hiring another two new tenure line faculty this year.
Congratulations.
It's just amazing. I mean, it's exhausting work, but it is really exciting to bring new folks on. And I'm very much the beneficiary of a legacy of people at this school that really value political economy. So all of our students, whether business economics is their major. So we have a business economics degree that's housed in a College of Arts and Sciences. So we're kind of ahead of the curve there in that right now, lots of business schools are looking at their programs and thinking that they've kind of missed the boat in their School of Professional Studies in terms of being able to incorporate the benefits of, you know, developing and thinking about an education that brings forth good citizens, and really focus too heavily on the narrow values of productivity, efficiency, profit, individuality, et cetera, that are, you know, the cores of neoclassical economics, really. So all of those students, whether in an economics major or the business economics major, start their journey with Political Economy and Social Thought 105. And that class, you know, is taught by four or five of us, and we rotate those sections, and all of us approach it in a little bit of a different way. We share different textbooks and procedures. I myself have taught it a host of different ways. It's a really hard class to teach just because you want to do everything. So do I start with Adam Smith in 1776 and sort of work through it chronologically to the modern day? Or do I start with the modern day and then work backward, deconstructing those things? Or do we construct it based on thinkers? Do we construct it based on ideas? You know, I go back and forth. This semester, I'm teaching it as an honors section. And the core, you know, this is one of the things that I'm guilty of. I'll read a book in the summer and I get really excited and I think this is going to be a game changer. It's going to be an awesome read for this class.
And you tell me about it.
Yeah, that's right. And then I read it for the second or third time as I'm teaching it. And I'm like, God, why did I do this to myself? And this book is that, it's Robert Shiller's Narrative Economics. And it's actually been better than I just said, but you know, Shiller, right, is, you know, as big a name in the orthodoxy as you could probably put forward, but he's really wrestling with this idea that narrative matters and it influences the length, duration, severity, etc., of financial crisis. But he falls a little bit short of really digging into the structures that are causing crisis, right? The Great Depression lasted longer than it needed because people kept talking about unemployment in various ways. And it's not that people were actually unemployed that was the problem. And bubbles in real estate happened because everybody's talking about like how great it is that their house price is going up, and it creates irrational exuberance and all these things. And no mention whatsoever at all of deregulation and assets and, you know, that the U.S. economy was, you know, creating the environment for this and these stories. And so it's a good book for kind of thinking about just how shallow a lot of orthodox analysis can really be, and that we need a little bit more complexity in the way that we're thinking about these things to really prevent and understand and make these sorts of crises less painful for the people that bear the brunt of it. And so far, so good. I mean, it's been a great sort of reintroduction to the classroom post-pandemic in a way that has been so rewarding, as, you know, these students have really engaged with the reading and are giving me a hard time. Like, they're predicting, like, that I'm not going to like this chapter and the reasons why I didn't really care for it. And it's just been a really good semester so far. So, and I think, you know, as department chair, the most rewarding part of that job is classroom visits. So, you know, as part of the evaluation of the quality of our teaching and maintaining a strong culture of teaching, the department chair has to visit anybody who's coming up for a particular review. And, you know, I'm just blown away by how much thought and care and energy our faculty puts into their classes. And I've stolen a few techniques here and there that have been very useful in my classes. I think my favorite is the use of the software Perusal. Do you guys, are you guys familiar with that?
Just got something in my inbox about it. I've not used it before.
Yeah, it's been great. Because it's like Brightspace or any of those other online learning management systems, but it allows you to highlight and comment in the readings and everybody can see it. So the students really appreciate it because they say it feels like we're reading it together. And the other really nice thing about it is it keeps information and collects statistics on how long students are in the document. So they can't just open it and leave it open. So for example, it'll say it was open for 24 hours, but they were active in it for 7 minutes. So I can give people a little bit of a hard time and be like, all right, let's see if we can build that stamina from 7 minutes to 21 minutes. And maybe by the end of the semester, a solid hour, maybe 45 minutes consistently in the readings. And then we'll really be, you know, cooking with some gas and getting some things done.
I want to talk about Schiller a bit more. What was the name of the book again?
It's called Narrative Economics. See, I got the
maybe a word for it could be a foil, right, for the class. It's like you're teaching through critique of the book. And in our last episode, we talked with Larry Johnson, and that's how he sort of shared his story of coming into heterodox economic thinking was through critique of Samuelson. And would it be fair to say that Schiller's like on par with a modern Samuelson? Not quite every classroom.
Yeah. He's kind of been my but it's been a fascinating book because, you know, it was published in 2019, just before the pandemic, and the subtitle is How Stories Go Viral and Drive Major Economic Events. So the whole metaphor throughout is about contagion and virus, and so narrative is always this sickness that's happening. So one of the questions we ask is, you know, can we write some positive stories? Are there some good ways that we can, you know, turn this ship around?
And does he not really allow for that?
My reading is that I don't even know that it's crossed his mind.
Is this meant for a popular audience, do you think, more likely? Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why, you know, it's a good one for the 105. And you know, I wish one of the things that I would like to see more heterodox folks do is write sort of this 100 level book. You know, we're kind of confined to either, you know, publishing in our journals and writing these really heady books or, you know, the textbooks, like I said, for 105, they're either sort of this featuring the great thinker sort of way or there's not really a whole lot of like
accessible heterodox.
Yeah. I really like, you know, Raj Batal has got a book, The Value of Nothing. That's actually, it was published in 2008, I think. So it's starting to get a little bit dated. But it aligns so nicely with, as the critique that I levy against microeconomics in my 300 level economics course. So starting with Homo economicus and the individual consumer, and then thinking about the corporation and the firm. And he has a nice chapter on value theory. And then the second half of the book kind of explores alternatives in forms of democracy that allow us to think about the state and, you know, firms that aren't maximizing profits and nonprofits and co-ops and all those sorts of things. So, I mean, I guess there are a few. I just wish that they came out and got as much acclaim and fancy book jackets.
Can't buy them in the airport. So, like that one. Yeah. So I want to talk about that 100 level heterodox economics intro book and see what we think would need to be in there. But before we do, I want to is there an index or are there sources cited in that book? I'm just curious because it seems to me like what Schiller's describing is also like incredibly derivative and a story that's been told a bunch of times. And I wonder to what extent there's like any kind of citational practice in there?
It's pretty shallow. And he tells, you know, for a second he talks about MMT, but it's, you know, I can't remember the exact straw man that he uses, but it's really bad. And so those are good things, right? When they, you know, to be able to point out and say, you know, this is the way people write in these books, similar to the textbook in our economics class, right? They write things like, and instead of saying in our model, they say that if the government provides a, you know, a tax incentive to increase investment, it's going to eventually, it's going to increase interest rates, right? Instead of saying in our model that has all of these assumptions, if the government provides an incentive, then our model predicts that interest rates will rise. And there really should be much more thought to that. There's just no room for thinking that what the model does is not going to happen in reality, which is really problematic. Especially, you know, when you teach like a loanable fund situation and, you know, go through all that and the interest rates going all over the place. And then, you know, at the end, we really should say, but none of that really actually happens because the interest rate is a policy variable. So I don't know. It's really hard. Having been trained in neoclassical economics and spending all that time, you know, when you think about it from an intellectual project, the idea that we can model the economy using these tools of physics, right? It's actually pretty creative and kind of a fun idea. But at some point, you know, the fun idea and the fact that it just keeps failing us, at what point can we abandon it and just stop teaching this stuff? I don't know.
You've told me about how you teach orthodox economics in the past, and I think you've referred to metaphors of building blocks. There might have been Legos involved at some point.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is model building. And, you know, the microeconomics, the 300 level class we teach, I teach the textbook and we develop the model in all of its, you know, calculus glory and drive the demand curve and the law of demand and find our supply curves. And then we go through meticulously all the assumptions of the perfectly competitive market. And, you know, we do the whole shebang in all of its glory, straight out, honest. And I even, you know, speak about like its elegance and, you know, how it is sort of captivating to think that, you know, we could somehow harness the power of physics to like control and think about unemployment and inflation and all these things. And, you know, what we derive is, you know, partial equilibrium. And the way that I present it toward the end is that, you know, what we've accomplished, right? People like Alfred Marshall did, and all the economists, long lines of them have done this work. And since then, it's developed into general equilibrium. And from general equilibrium, we get dynamic, stochastic general equilibrium. And really all that's occurring is that we've gone from what we did in this class, which is the Duplo Lego model of the economy, right? All you really are doing when you get to the more sophisticated is you've made the pieces smaller and more complicated and much more painful when you step on them as a parent. And, you know, but at the end of the day, the pieces are all the same, right? The rational agent, the efficient firm, you've just made it much more rigorous in the assumptions. And the assumptions actually become even more narrow and less like reality the more complex the math gets. So there's like an inverse relation between the two. And,
for example,
so, you know, to get to general equilibrium, you've got to assume perfect information. And you don't necessarily need perfect information in the simpler partial equilibrium model. So things just get more and more convoluted.
So is there a theory of the press that goes along with how perfect information circulates?
Oh man, that's a good question. I'm not aware of it off the top of my head. That would be an exogenous shock that, you know, the press is presenting information in the wrong way or something like. What's the press? Is there a market? Where are they exchanging their words?
Oh, so much narrative, so much viral narrative getting in the way. Yeah. We need more monetary silencing.
It's an exogenous shock to the system that will create a short-term perturbation and then will return to normal.
So the rational agents get their information by simply using their five senses and by looking at the market.
Oh, I don't even know that they have five senses. Right? I mean,
they're just brains in a vat.
Yeah, you know, they're agents, right? They're solving optimal problems, and really, it's not even so much that they're agents or things that, because we're not even really looking at them. We're looking at the optimal points that emerge from their decisions. So, you know, the aggregation. So economics, right, from the free market perspective, is just constantly aggregating choices, optimal choices, to form these structures that we call the demand curve, the supply curve. And then there's one magic optimal point that's at equilibrium.
Subjectivity is a veil over real aggregate relations.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we should invite Mitch Green into this sort of conversation, because he is the master of the neoclassical language and jokes. They're like the neoclassical dad jokes. he's the master. We go through that, and does this Death Star model, right, of Legos really tell us any more about how we behave and who we are and what's going on in the economy than the Duplo one? I'm not really sure that it does. And I really, you know, I wish they had to go through and say all the assumptions every time they like make a proclamation about like what's going to happen in this policy choice. Because it's really an unfair, you know, even in their papers or in the, you know, a presentation, they would just say, assume the standard assumptions. If they even acknowledge the assumptions at all. And that's, you know, it just presents theirs as like, this is the way that it is. And then when you critique or raise an alternative, you have to deconstruct all that stuff. So it's almost like you're reproducing it again in your own head, and then they're listening to you reproduce it again. And then by the time you get to the punchline, they're like, well, you just said all the same things. And you know, you just talk past each other all the time.
And then you've cited the hell out of us in our Orthodox journals.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I feel like the kind of this by now pretty standard or standardized approach that like Schiller seems to be taking in that book, without having read it, but having your description in hand, is like to identify narrative, or there's fundamentally a defensive posture in it. It's like what we're doing is not narrative. Everything else is narrative, right? And to the extent that we can detect narrative, that's the extent to which we can detect that we're straying from, you know, our Death Star model, and we're out in kook land.
Yeah. Please stop telling all these stories, because you're like shocking people's preferences, right. And they're not making optimal choices anymore. Yeah. Whereas maybe, right, the fact that we let people take out a bunch of mortgages without proving income, that's why we got a bubble.
Right. And the trick there is that you can always locate narrative in those points of breakdown. There's no narrative at the optimal point, but there is always narrative at the non-optimal points, right? The irrational.
Yeah. And, you know, Schiller is clearly very much influenced in thinking about the Great Depression. And so lots of the narratives and stories that he tells about consumption and frugality and the way that things move through that period, you know, come up throughout the book. And so one of the things that we've brought up in the class as a counter is the interview you did on the myth of the redemptive depression, right? Which really goes into sort of the, you know, how these stories come about and why they come about and what it was actually like and what was going on and, you know, the vivid descriptions of what it means to, you know, have nowhere to go and to be hungry and to be trying to, you know, care for children through this time period. And, you know, at some points even having to give up your children, you know, that sort of thing is why narrative and story carries on through generations. Not that it was a shoeshine boy telling Rockefeller that, you know, something bad's going to happen. So yeah. And when you get the redemptive depression, narrative, thinking about that, you know, grandma's here because she, you know, had local supply chains and, you know, worked hard and made it through and came out of this morally stronger, you know. And then you transition to the 60s and the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King talking about the right for jobs for all. And, well, why do we need jobs for all? Like the New Deal didn't really actually do anything to allocate resources. Like, what's the argument here? And then, you know, then you can pull back these sorts of silly individualist stories and think more holistically about all the things that are interconnected in our lives and, you know, the importance of work and jobs and stability and risk and why we study what we study and all these sort of bigger questions that are much more interesting and fundamental. So you guys, big shout out to the podcast. And I mean, I love returning to this catalog and listening to these episodes, and there's just so much in this podcast that is so applicable. And it's, you know, the value, right? Like I was saying, that there aren't these accessible books, right? Lots of the books and the people that you guys talk to, like the books aren't appropriate for the class, but hearing them discuss their books and their work in the podcast is. So it's sort of like an introduction to how to critically read and how to think about what an author might be trying to do in the way that they're structuring their books and their articles and their research. So in those ways, it's so useful, especially from a heterodox perspective, to be able to think about what are these different methodologies? What are these different tools that we can use to start understanding these economic outcomes from different perspectives? Because one of the challenges of being a heterodox economist is, you know, there's no like, this is our method, right? This is our toolbox. This is what we do. We're not going to stray from it.
And it's automated. Right?
Where's my beta hat? Like, it just, you know, it's really much more eclectic, and we're like always wrestling and grappling toward, you know, what is a social science methodology that, you know, can give us meaningful and useful knowledge.
Well, that's the thing, like meaning and purpose as kind of objectives versus, the just kind of internal model consistency. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Let's tell a really good story about utopia. And there you have it. Right. And that's frustrating too, right? The, you know, socialism gets painted as this utopian narrative, but, you know, free market economics is the most utopian story maybe ever told, right? That autonomous individuals with no constraints will spontaneously decide that these tokens are money and that all of us transacting and doing things will lead to a harmonious and good society. Like, what? This is crazy talk. Like, we can't even spontaneously agree what to get for dinner most nights. Society is supposed to spontaneously believe, you know, oh, this is our medium of exchange because it has intrinsic value.
So, you know, I think our listeners, at least our longtime listeners, know you on this podcast in part because you are a pioneer of classroom and university currency experiments, where you model so-called tax-driven money as an obligation to the institution, as the foundation for monetary production. And I think often when we gloss those experiments, we're doing so in different contexts. But now we've invited you on to talk about economics pedagogy and in a more kind of holistic way. So what happens with these classroom experiences what happens with these service learning currency experiments in relation to learning about orthodox economic models, the different models of equilibrium, different heterodox models? How do conversations get started, or how do students metabolize, make sense of all of these things in conversation with one another?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's, you know, one that has changed really every single time I've issued a currency in the classroom, and it really depends on what classroom. So it started off that I would only do it in the 105 class as an introduction, so that they would know what I'm talking about when we get to the upper level classes, or at least have been introduced to it. But now I'm gravitating toward that I just need to do it in all my classes, so that when they get to the upper level classes, then maybe they already have some of the currency already in possession and it's transferring between time periods. I mean, this is what Fadl has been able to successfully do at Denison, is sort of this intergenerational thing. And I've just not quite ever I think I was building up toward that pre-pandemic, especially with, you know, the debt theme that was going on campus and bringing people like Stephanie Kelton to talk. And we still have to get you up there, Scott, to give your talk that was canceled, like so much else that fateful spring. But yeah, this semester, the last time I did it with a digital money, and they had wallets, and that had its own sort of fun to it. But this semester I went back to just paper money, and it's a comparative approaches in political economy class where, you know, we're looking at the differences in methodologies in political economy from orthodox and heterodox around questions of money and how it works and what it does. And the primary text in the class are the classic 10 Men of Money Island that I learned about from Jakob Weinig, which is really pretty fascinating, just because who knew you could write an imaginary story about money that's grounded in, you know, state theories of money.
Tell us about it.
It's really fascinating and terrific. And, you know, the characters in the book are named after kind of what they do. So like Sledgehammer and Reaper, the agriculturalist. And then the name for the government person is Do Nothing. And then the name of the banker is Discount. But it really builds this story, right? You know, they're all kind of doing their own thing, and they're, you know, they're building their community on this, you know, fantasy island, and they decide that they need a bridge, right? They've set up shop in ways that, you know, now they're spending so much time like getting around the island that it would really benefit everybody if we just had a bridge right in the middle. And, you know, they've wrestled with how they're going to, how they're going to do it. How are we going to mobilize the resources to build this bridge? And basically what they arrive at is do nothing writes notes to prove that you spent time building the bridge. And they set a timeline for when you're going to have to prove that you contributed equally to the building of the bridge. And so there's a central ledger, and just do nothing is issuing this new money. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's comical. I don't know if it's intentionally satirical, like these conversations that they're having and thinking like Sledgehammer is spending a lot of time on the bridge, but the guy that does all the textile creation and clothing isn't spending any. He's so excited about these new shirts, and he's got extra shirts, and Sledgehammer has extra money. And what on earth are they going to do? And so at the end, right, they get a bridge, and everybody's contributed to the building of the bridge, or they've been able to contribute to those who have built to the bridge. And, you know, all the money gets turned back in, and they're like, all right, great. What should we do now? And then the idea comes up, well, I've seen this shiny stuff in the river. Maybe we should go dig that up, and that will be how we establish what the money is, like this gold. And so they spend like the next chapter, they're like, some of them are digging up this river and bringing all this gold, and they're issuing their monies. And at the end, they're like, oh, what did that do? All we've got now is a ruined river and this big pile of gold, which is so Bitcoin, right? It's just like, oh, what do we have now? We got like all this carbon coal that we burned in China, and, you know, nothing really to show for it. So that book is, you know, good, like sort of like gets them imagining money and gets them thinking about, like, you know, it goes all the way through. I mean, it's like the finance franchise gets developed with the creation of the bank and their over-reliance on debt and not issuing credit through the state anymore. And, you know, the bank gets really greedy, and then the state colludes with the bank to, you know, do its thing. And then at the end, they start over, and they're like, well, we're not going to fall for that stuff again. And then we read Jakob's Moral Economies of Money and the parallels between the development and the experimentation and the wrestling with theories of value and production. And, you know, money is a democratic medium, and, you know, that it mobilizes production, and the scarcity of money really seems to be a significant problem. And that we can solve the scarcity of money problem by creating more money. You know, it's starting to sort of sink in, right? And along the way, we've listened to Sally's interview with you guys to think about the finance franchise. And then we show Bob and their diagrams and their paper. And now that we've gotten to sort of Bitcoin and thinking about digital currencies, right, that allows us to think again about the importance of the philosophy that's undergirding the monies, right? So, you know, this idea of individual, decentralized exchange, and that it's not what's producing stuff. And I think it's starting to sink in, and you know, they've got given some good presentations and done some nice group work, and now they've been assigned, right? I've given them all jobs at the Federal Reserve, and so their final project is to use the criteria and the four sort of big questions about, you know, where does the money come from? How much should we produce? How do we create demand for that money? Right? How do we do these things? And those criteria, and thinking about, you know, should we just edit the U.S. dollar, right? Some of the ways that it enters the economy, or how much we should produce, or the tax circuit, or do we need new monies in New York State or here in Cortland, like our classroom currency, right? It seems to be working. We're mobilizing resources. We're solving problems. You guys are getting interesting and meaningful work done for, you know, loaves and fishes and the SBCA. And, you know, we're gathering data with our partners in the Adirondacks about HVAC providers that are part of New York State's bigger plan to reduce carbon emissions and move to energy efficiency. So we're doing all sorts of these like little things that are adding up, hopefully, to big things. And, you know, do we need the federal government to issue the money or change the money, or can you do it at a local level? And all those sorts of questions really challenge the idea of governance, and they challenge the idea of this inside outside the state and market. And I'm having a lot of fun, and I think some of them are having a lot of fun. We'll see. We're having writers' workshop meetings before the break to kind of go over their project and talk one-on-one, which I think always helps sort of ground the community and get us off on the right track. But yeah, I don't know if that answered the question. Next semester with Urban, I want to continue sort of the same projects in the Adirondacks, but we'll think about it from the, you know, the urban economics perspective and land use and data and GIS and all that sort of stuff. It's pretty fascinating.
I love this. And I think we've come full circle because we're right back at narrative economics, but now it's not a dirty virus that gets in the way of distorting optimal preferences, but instead is the lifeblood of provisioning as an imaginative process. And I guess my next question for you that you started to kind of answer is, you know, you asked them to write these proposals. What are the strategies? What are the genres that they can write in? I mean, are they writing? Are they telling stories? Are they? You say that they maybe mobilize.
Yeah. So
data in different ways.
You know, I'm hoping that in our individual meetings, as we're wrestling with their idea, that I'll be able to sort of suggest various opportunities. So, you know, they could be doing an interview on a podcast. So it could be an interview that they could write, or the standard sort of like field guide case study sort of style is one of the ways that I think is pretty straightforward and that translates well for professional writing and thinking about that. The writing assignment that has the most freedom that I've given this semester is in that 105 class, the Schiller class, where I asked them to write their own economic narrative, and it's 2050. So, you know, and it, I just kind of picked 2050 randomly, but it's actually just about exactly the difference between my age and their age right now. So that kind of helps them think about, well, it could be this huge radical change, or it could be sort of still looking fairly similar, but they have the freedom to, you know, write a dystopia or a utopia and use like the different context and stories and what catches fire. How do we rethink the individual as, you know, cooperative and altruistic and always interdependent, or do we keep beating our brains against the wall and trying to separate ourselves and isolate ourselves and be individuals, homo economicus. So I think I'm really hoping that these conversations are as fun as I anticipate them being, and that, you know, they have the chance to like free their minds from all the constraints that exist, right? And, you know, what is the problem that is keeping you up at night, right? What is it, just about getting a job, or are you worried about climate? And, you know, let's work through and think about, you know, the work that you might do for the rest of your career to make a meaningful and useful contribution to solving that issue. And what sort of institutions and support would you need to do that? And so hopefully we're getting there, because so much of what we talk about is how dire things are, the crises, and it's awful. But at the same time, we really have to equip them with the vision and the ability to envision a really better world than we currently have. And I think that that's something that most, at least generations since World War II in this country, have kind of had. And that's sort of, that's under attack right now. you know, as even as the data suggest, right, that this is like the, this generation of students has got a less than 50-50 shot of having a better income and life outcome than this current generation. And that's kind of terrifying and sad. So we don't want to shackle them with those sorts of doomsday scenarios. I mean, we need to take it seriously, but God, we got to give them the tools and the freedom to think about it. What a good and just and verdant and exciting and healthy world looks like.
I love that so much. What does a rubric look like? What is an A paper for its convincing portrayal of a dystopia achieved by Goldbug resurrection and insurrection, or
yeah,
the intensity of your feeling of joy and euphoria at the vision of you know, a post Green New Deal world that they give you? How do you grade this thing?
So there's, you know, there's specific parameters. Like one of the most important parameters that I think students need to get familiar with is following directions. You know, 12 font, double spaced, you know, and then familiarity about, you know, where to turn it in. So I use OneDrive and things like this where they've got to like navigate folders and submit it to the correct space. And then this is an iterative project, so they'll submit an abstract or an outline, and I'll provide comments. How well do you address the comments that I've provided? There's a number of quotations and references that I'm looking for that intertwine the readings and the materials in the course. And then, you know, I get a little bit of leeway with something like creativity to sort of emphasize that, you know, try to have fun with this. And I experienced this as an undergrad, right? My growth and development teacher, her assignment was to, you know, you are now the leader of this developing country, implement your economic strategy. And I tried to find this paper because I know that I wrote a super neoliberal, like,
Crazy,
microloans for everybody. Terrible, like, I mean, and I remember like thinking that it's so good and so, you know, free markets and yes, because, you know, like everything, you get so influenced by what it is that you're reading in the moment. And I remember that, you know, I got a good grade because I used all the references and I followed directions, and it was a pretty good story, I think. But I could tell that the teacher was just like, oh my God, like, how did he just totally miss the point of this class? So, you know, I'll have some love for, you know, the gold bug emergence and
softens
Bitcoin
the blow, right?
Decentralization occurs, right? You know, because we all go through, you know, you gotta have a intellectual crisis at least once in your life, or you're not thinking hard enough.
Provisioning intellectual crises with Benjamin Wilson.
I love it. It's like a good 1-2 punch would be you and Larry, right? Like, because his kind of inductive approach alongside your critical narrative driven approach.
Well, you know, it's so exciting to hear that somebody is teaching future teachers how to wrestle with this stuff. Like, you know, can you imagine the system of education that, you know, is cultivating an understanding as money as a productive promise that we are announcing to each other, right, all the time? You know, the Uni project and, you know, the classroom currencies and thinking through Jakob's book, and, you know, the whole thing is really these folks just like wrestling with like how to organize productive activity. And, you know, this tool is either being used really well or really ineffectively all along the way. And if we could harness that spirit of experimentation throughout our educational curriculum, right, the same way that we've like allowed Homo economicus to like infiltrate every dimension of our educational system, right? All of our disciplines and all of our laws, right? Going back to Oliver Wendell Holmes giving his bad man speech in Harvard Square, right? Like, how do we begin to disentangle and take apart all of these ugly structures that assume the worst in one another, and allow us the freedom to experiment and think about production and money and promises and so much more rewarding and effective ways? I would love to see money and this sort of thinking, right, is so much a part of social studies and even, you know, the sciences, right? How many great scientific experiments are, you know, submitted to the National Science Foundation that get turned down just because, you know, it's a random selection of the reviewers don't necessarily like this particular project or have an affinity to it. And so, you know, do 91% of the projects to the NSF not deserve to be funded?
And then there's the old...
I can't imagine that.
Thinking about the context of what gets submitted there is the stuff that is going to satisfy the expectations of the review committee. And that is, you know, sort of colloquially show that you already know what you're going to find, right? So discovery is not a priority in this discovery-oriented discipline as a result of monetary scarcity imposed from the top.
Yeah, the question of the unknown, right? And I think that in our conversations about, you know, what would it look like if we implemented this full employment program, and, you know, you don't know. I mean, any more than Jerome Powell knows what's going to happen if they raise the interest rates again, right? But there's like a certain amount of gravitas, or like, you know, so many people saying, oh yeah, this is what's going to happen, that we're allowed to experiment in that way, but, and not others. And it's so constraining and so narrow, and it's so self-defeating. It seems like people are finally, you know, at least in the moment, like Galbraith's piece the other day was really great, calling out Jason Furman and, oh, yeah, well, where's that 6.5% unemployment? You know, like, maybe we don't need to throw people out of work, and except for maybe you. And then maybe we can move forward with the business of, you know, finding those meaningful and useful jobs. I mean, that's one of the things selfishly why I like the classroom currencies and engaging with the nonprofit sector and these groups that are trying to solve some of our problems outside the business world, so to speak, is a little bit hard to imagine what all these jobs are going to be, right? And how many jobs we would actually need, and how long, you know, if we solve the problem of hunger, right? What's next? And, you know, what's the evolution of this new care-driven economy, and how much less material waste do we produce? And I think those sorts of unknowns are a lot less scary than, you know, the unknown of when we're going to burn the final tree on this planet. And, you know, the ocean isn't going to be able to support life anymore. I would much rather pursue these like other avenues of, when is there too much art? you know, when is the workday just way too short?
Wow. Yeah.
Right. Is it 3 hours? I put in my half hour today. AI cranked out the rest. And
I'd like to talk about the future of your department as chair. You've discuss with me a little bit in the past that your department is going through a kind of generational turnover, and that the curriculum had been divided and organized in a particular way, and the participants who put that plan into place are sort of phasing out and retiring, and it's raising the question of where to go from here. And like all these other topics that we are describing, there's no, you know, there's no automated map for you to follow. And obviously you're not doing this single-handedly. Being a chair is not being a dictator, or it should, no. It shouldn't be. So can you tell us a little bit about...
Unless I'm in charge.
Can you tell us a little bit about this history of the department and what kinds of questions, challenges, and aims seem to be bubbling up as you reckon with the question of the future of this institution?
I think, you know, this all happened well before my time, so that my institutional understanding of a lot of it is probably, you know, it's guided by conversations and things of this nature. But the short of it is that, you know, a long time ago, they made the decision to create a business economics degree in a liberal arts setting. And that turned out to be a really shrewd and an excellent move because, you know, over the course of the last 20 years, the department, rather than shrinking in size, has steadily grown. And now we're the largest department on campus in the liberal arts and sciences. And so we are operating from a position of strength and stability. And the success of that department and our students and those things are all terrific. And so, you know, we're wrestling with this question of, you know, out of these 500 majors that we have, 30 of them are economics majors. So how do we, you know, is the goal to have better balance between economics and the business economics? Is there a way to more robustly teach the business economics degree as sort of a pluralistic economics degree? And I'm a little bit torn. You know, I'm, as a political economist, I'd like to see us just teach all these political economy classes. But, you know, the work of Shamdutta Paul and Tankis on coordination rights and thinking about the firm has been something that I think fits really nicely in the literature for liberal arts management and thinking not of it as management, but as organizational studies, or what is it called? Organizational behavior is the new name. And I think that that's a great sort of way of introducing a lot of heterodox concepts and ideas into a business curriculum, right? So, you know, the sole proprietorship is going to organizationally behave significantly differently than the corporation or the worker-owned cooperative or the nonprofit. So it begins to introduce all the ways in which, you know, the corporation will maximize and fit these really narrow value systems, efficiency, production, shareholder value, whereas the Mondragon cooperative has managed to be a very successful global enterprise for multiple decades by embracing a much more holistic view in a democratic workplace. So I would love it to, you know, see us sort of embrace this idea of, you know, the structure of the organization really matters, and to be training students to adequately be able to assess whether or not I want to run and manage a corporation or a Mondragon. And I think that that would be infinitely more healthy. Social enterprise and, you know, sort of the budding hipness of social entrepreneurship, I think all sort of guide themselves to this idea that we could really create a robust and interesting liberal arts education that gives students the idea to think through these issues and even beyond, like, you know, it would turn right back to money, right? Where how we structure access and who creates and how it is entering the system and all those things become that coordination right as well. So there's no inside outside. We are always all practicing governance, you know, whether it's our department or our business or our family or a nation state, right? There's there's always the possibility for experimenting and decision making and collective decision making that we should be approaching. And, you know, with all the resources that we have here locally in the Finger Lakes for, you know, experimenting in farming and agriculture, tourism. And then that is just exacerbated up in the Adirondack Park with our partners and our campus up there. I think, you know, the possibilities for this really exciting new degree programs that, you know, aren't abandoning business or management, but framing them from a liberal arts perspective is super exciting. And, you know, that's not going to happen overnight. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, how the hiring process goes and that sort of thing. But I think it opens up the possibility, especially for grant writing and community partnerships and things in a really exciting and robust way that lots of people are excited about.
So where's podcasting fit into the new curriculum at SUNY Cortland in economics department?
That's a great question. You know, I think, you know, that's, you know, more than trying to get other faculty in my department to issue the currency, I would love the communications department to issue for the creation of new digital medias around, you know, the reporting and analysis of these new organizational structures that we're creating in the economics department to mobilize production. Because we need some good news and we need some good reporting and we need to desensationalize our need for breaking news and Donald Trump. Like, can we just take a time out from reporting about this person? Like, he's just not that interesting. And
a different kind of social media, in a very literal sense.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a guest speaker, I think it was last year, that she did the movie TikTok Boom. It was a pretty good and, you know, an interesting film about, you know, how TikTok is, you know, shaping our children's brains and, you know, how the algorithm works to keep you on it and engaged and how that works for influencing and all that. And, you know, the heart of the way that that application is structured is all around the idea of attention, and attention translates to profits. So, you know, how do we create apps that aren't about that, right? But, you know, TikTok has got some, you know, it's not all bad. Like, I think it helped my golf swing a little bit this season. But, and, you know, occasionally a nice recipe pops up. But, you know, otherwise it's just a time sink that is, you know, so unuseful. But, you know, TikTok and Facebook and all these folks are like starting to think, well, we need programmers, but we need programmers who understand some history and the humanities and can communicate.
And we can desperately not let them go to those platforms.
Yeah. Or take them.
Yeah.
Over.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe from the inside, but I'm wrapping up a course in media studies, and we just had a conversation about TikTok and the different platforms through Cory Doctorow's kind of lens of inshittification. Are you familiar with this one? Right? The platforms like TikTok, Facebook are designed to degrade, right? Essentially, in terms of quality of the experience. They begin as these big hospitable places in order to get people in, and then the more people get settled in, the less they feel like they can leave. And that's when they turn the levers and start making life more shitty, right? In Doctorow's theoretical lens. And so it talked about with the students, like, what would it take for that to not, for this insidification to be reversed? And, you know, not to just keep talking about old Money on the Left episodes, but let's do it. Kim Stanley Robinson, a critical portion of the utopian, you know, mostly utopian near future version of climate catastrophe. Part of the story is the development of a public social media, right? A publicly funded and non-surveillance driven, non-ad driven, open platform for social, you know, interaction online. That's where we should send the historians, right? Like, let's build something new and, you know, as utopian and far off as that can seem, it seems pretty important.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, when you read about the New Deal and the amazing archives and interviews about, you know, family members of former slaves and, you know, the catalog that was developed in that time period, how are we going to know about this time period in the future, right? Like, you know, where is this data going and who's cataloging it? Who's, you know, our department is full of file cabinets with, you know, all the documents that have recorded the history of what's been going on at our institution. And now they're all, you know, on our U drives. Like, where do those go in the future? And will we even know what our history was as this technology gets wiped out? And so I think that's a lot of meaningful and useful work that's not getting done right now, or at least I'm not aware of how it's getting done or what it would look like, that our vision of things change as we change what, you know, meaningful and useful production is, instead of just like, how do we streamline this to be cost effective all the time?
Do you get resistance in the classroom? Somebody who's just team homo economicus and insists on as much?
I think it's so hard for them to, you know, see where I'm coming from ideologically. I think, like, I don't know if they know when to be resistant or not. You know, even when I teach, you know, the 301, I do 2/3 of the class all neoclassical and 1/3 of the class orthodox, heterodox micro, with the critique of the neoclassical throughout. And at the end, you know, I'll have 2 or 3 students ask me, so are you an orthodox or a heterodox economist? And the real answer is that you got to be both. I mean, you got to keep up with what's going on so that you're not straw manning them the way that they do us. But, you know, as far as I can tell, the neoclassical model still remains the driving force of so much of the thinking that's going on. I mean, you know, in the Twitterverse, they'll say, oh, no, we don't. That's not informing our research. And then, you know, they'll post their textbook diagrams in their threads below. Like, I don't know. And I've gotten a little bit away from that because I feel like there's a little bit of dishonesty there. So in recent years, I've just flat out said, I was a really staunch neoclassical orthodox economist. I was in a PhD program and I became disenchanted with what the school of thought was delivering. And I no longer had the feeling that I was doing something that was going to make the world a better place. And I really felt lost and I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I left school for a number of years and worked in the professional environment. And then I found this other school of thought that I could return to be part of the academy and teach. And that was all very exciting. And so here I am. And every once in a while, I you know, look back and I, you know, I'll wrestle with some of the ideas in these pieces and I'll be like, oh, well, maybe that is, you know, a meaningful move forward. And so I think, you know, as long as you're never 100% sure of what you're doing, you know, students respect that. And, you know, they have the freedom to be an orthodox economist. Like, I'm not going to tell them no. Like, if you want to do your orthodox maximization problems and you find joy and excitement and you think that that's going to make the world a better place, then go for it. Right. I mean,
just imagining what that looked like. Yeah.
Oof. Yeah. I don't, you know, my, my master's thesis at Kansas was a factor model. So what's the impact of institutions on economic growth and development? And there was this like really interesting government data that was all like categorical variables about whether or not they were a dictatorship or not. And, you know, the houses of how their government was divided. And, you know, it was an interesting, fun exercise. And, you know, it turns out that institutions with more democracies have better economic outcomes.
Hey. You get a so, hell of a grant for that one, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, so you can still tell the good stories from that perspective, I suppose. But I find much more joy and excitement in thinking about, you know, social science methodologies and how to roll in the humanities and institutional structures and human behavior is not an individual thing, but it's a collective. And so I'm gonna stay there for now. How did your class end up, Billy, that I talked to? Like, how were those projects?
Yeah, so in that class that you visited over Zoom to talk about classroom currencies, class is called Money, Culture, and Media, or MCM. You're into acronyms. and of course, it's from the MFT perspective. And we kind of end the course. Each student is sort of tasked with designing a complementary currency for use in the New Orleans area here, whether that's in the city or on campus. So we had a lot of fun. They did presentations of them. So at the end of the semester, we held a sort of a vote. Right. And the top ones were going to be passed on to the next class. So that the next class would inherit the top proposals and then develop and refine those proposals. And then with the idea of an iterative design. So I think my intervention from the communication perspective was on the design and the discussion and the deliberation back end. Whereas I think a lot of the existing excellent classroom currency assignments are about design, but then it's also implementation. And I'm intimidated as hell of actually rolling out the classroom currency and managing it.
Yeah, I get that apprehension. And that's probably the most common thing that I hear from folks when I'm like, why don't you do this?
Well, I would say too, like another hang up, right? So there's that. And I think it's understandable. But we also in that class talk about grades and debt, like in the framework of debt, and you earn credits, and we're in this whole accreditation system and so on. So it ends up being usually a pretty interesting conversation. We're talking about the rhetoric of debt in economics, and then we just locate it everywhere, right? And Lakoff and all that stuff. And to what extent, like using the classroom currency as a sort of stand-in for or as a part of their grade is sort of a redundant thing to do, right? And what are we actually achieving other than introducing complexity to the situation in the form of, I mean, maybe complexity is community, complexity is buy-in, and maybe that's worthwhile. I'm asking you, I guess, like if a student comes up and says, well, isn't this just sort of the same as 10 points that you were already going to assign me based on work that I did? And I guess for me, the answer is yes, but we have now talked about it, right? As opposed to it just being the de facto.
Yeah. I think that having the grade component, right, whether it's 10% or 5%, and that you get that part of the grade through the redemption of the money that you've issued opens up the conversation about coercion. Like how was it even necessary for me to implement this tax? Would I have gotten the same result and the same amount of productive activity without it? Right. How much, you know, cause 10% of a grade for the semesters, it's a pretty good chunk. But it's also a chunk that they're guaranteed to get 100% of if they do the work. So I think it gives them the choice, right? How much of this am I going to do? What am I going to do? How coercive is this actually, right? Because I also have students that just flat out choose not to show up for a midterm. Right. So I think it's an interesting way of thinking about what we're actually getting out of this credit process and out of education and how much we're buying into the way that we're like chunking up these classes and saying, well, was what you learned working for Loaves and Fishes really 10% of what the learning outcome of this class was, or was it way more, you know, maybe the most enriching and fundamentally eye-opening component of the class versus, you know, the 25% that I gave you for the paper, the particular readings and all these sorts of things. And so I think it is worth the physical issuance and redemption process to really drive home that it comes from a particular place first, and that we're not recycling tax money, and that I can always deliver my promise of 10% of your grade, just as the state can always deliver on whatever it is that we collectively promise, whether it's, you know, whatever $1 trillion in military spending is supposed to deliver for us versus, you know, however much money I have to mobilize in this class to get the data that I need. We are capable, as we the people, of making whatever promise we the people want to make. And I think, you know, employment, education, healthcare, and all those things are there if we want to mobilize in this different way. And wondering and thinking through what the redemption process is and the circuit and how we create demand for satisfying each other's collective promises, I think is an important exercise in thinking about our theories of value.
Seems to me that it introduces the question of, but also a legitimately new structure of receivability in the classroom and beyond and among the students, right? Because grades are and credits that they're earning without the currency, those are receivable kind of higher up the food chain. Those are receivable in the wider institution and then in different ways on the job market, maybe for getting into a graduate program, right? There's many ways in which those grades that they are earning are receivable, but right, we call cheating, right? If they like if they try to do kind of horizontal coordination, which I refuse to call exchange, but that's just me. If they are horizontally coordinating, that's an illegitimate liquidity, right? whereas, at least the way I've heard it described by you, Ben, and Fadl, and some others, there is the possibility for horizontal liquidity in, right? And that's different than the more vertical. The vertical redemption or the vertical liquidity of the teacher to students relationship.
Yeah. I don't think it's ever happened where I didn't have a number of students do way more than they needed to satisfy the tax obligation. And that might be because, you know, they were already doing this work beforehand, or, you know, you're doing community service by mandate already, or, you know, there's all sorts of things going on. But there's also the situation in which the student was like, this was so awesome that I kept going back, right? This student that was going to feed people at Loaves and Fishes was, this is the most rewarding and eye-opening thing about, you know, people and life. I just did more of it. And that's part of it too, right? That when you find reward in your work, that is so insanely valuable. And I think that's as important a thing to be teaching our students as anything else, right? It's not just about clocking in and clocking out, right? We want to find meaningful and useful work. And I love that terminology for the full employment program. So at the end, right, as we're closing in on tax day, right, there's those students that have way more than they need, and there's students that still haven't done anything. So, you know, I've issued more than enough to collect to satisfy a balanced budget. Should I just close the opportunities and you guys can now turn to Jimmy and Sarah and Samantha and you guys can go work for them because now they're the private sector. So that you can get the money that you need to pay the taxes and, you know, and then we will hold a vote, right? Should we keep the government open at the risk of running a budget deficit and a full employment program? Or should we, you know, allow you guys to, you know, reevaluate your life choices and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and go do some volunteering or gather the data that we're working with our community partners to build on. And, you know, and it's, you know, 17 hands go up to keep the government open and one hand will go up to close it. You know, it's so those sorts of things are surprising and unexpected. And, you know, you would think that this, you know, when you describe it, it just sounds like all the students will go and do exactly 10 hours of community service and that'll be the end of it. But there's inevitably these, you know, students are unpredictable, right? Just like all of us are. We all have things going on in life. And the question about whether or not, you know, these folks had already had these volunteer opportunities lined up for them, is that fair? Is, you know, it was so easy for them. Like, and I had to go find it. And so it opens up all those sorts of really good and interesting discussions that don't happen unless some of them have the money and some of them don't.
You know, I've been thinking recently a lot about my 15-year-old son who is part of this pretty great, I mean, you know, we'd like to see college being free for all and open enrollment in all these ways. But, you know, living in the state of Florida, we have a program called Bright Futures. And if you get a certain GPA and you fulfill a number of requirements, basically your tuition is taken care of at a public university, which, you know, I mean, the future of the public university system in the state of Florida is another kind of impending question. But one of the key requirements is 100 hours of community service. And my son's been doing a lot of these hours, you know, usually tries to get in an hour a week or so. And I keep thinking about, you know, what a tremendous mobilization of young people and their labor. And my son will go to a local nonprofit that serves communities in need. And, you know, whether it's about food service or, you know, working in their thrift shop or, you know, he does any number of things. That's a lot of money, right? That is a lot of money. That is a lot of labor. And I just, and yet we put out a proposal for a university currency system at the federal level and people think we are insane, right? And how do we live in a world in which...
And our workers are old enough to work.
Yeah. How do we live in a world in which one of those, you know, one of those models is gigantic, tremendous in a currently super right-wing state, and the other one is absolutely nuts, is unthinkable. And in fact, they're not that different. And I think that the pedagogical experiment of the classroom currency in constant dialogue and in this reflexive relationship around the institution and grades and coercion can be one way of pulling down the kind of conceptual barriers that make one of those sound totally rational and doable, which it is because it's happening every single day in the state of Florida, versus these other proposals.
I would imagine none of these students that are trying to participate are having any trouble finding work. There's so much that needs to be done. And, you know, I applaud the idea there. I think that maybe that's a way of merging, right, and thinking through the transition from high school to college and higher learning in an interesting way, right? I mean, talk about, you know, having exposure to like some really important social and environmental issues and going into college with those ideas already in mind, and then having that experience to be able to continue to grow on your, on what it is that you've done in the past in new places with new people and organizations and build capacity in those areas that doesn't exist when we're only relying on volunteerism. Right? And that's really the hardest thing that occurs. And, you know, I've built really good partnerships here and, you know, but all of my partners are dependent on soft money, and lots of people work in these places as long as they can. And then the reality of expenses and mortgages and family, right? And the turnover in this space is just nonstop. And you know, programs just end on a fiscal date and then you got to start over again. And so if we can, you know, if this program could grow and provide them with that sort of monetary labor stability such that, you know, we're always building capacity and growing and achieving these goals and objectives and missions, then that would be terrific. But we're still...
The transitory nature of public good inflation. People come in and doing good work and then they gotta go.
Yeah, that's that, you know, and that's why I've always, you know, the buffer stock is an interesting pedagogical tool. And, you know, should we choose gold or labor? But, you know, if it's really meaningful and useful work, you don't want people just like picking up and going because they got a higher bid in the private sector. That's not really building capacity and stabilizing communities and the sort of way that I think creates this ongoing social cohesion and environmental awareness and respect for human life that we, you know, I think it just falls into that trap that we're like automatons making choices and doing our own thing rather than part of this much bigger collective that is really something that we need to be more aware of.
This has been really great. Ben Wilson, thank you so much for joining us on Money on the Left.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And please, please, if you want to issue your own currency and experiment with this, I am always open to talking and chatting. You can reach me on Twitter at AutoEston77 and a similar handle on Blue Sky. I'm just starting there. So, but bcw@cortland.edu is my email, and that's where I'm bombarded every day by all sorts of things. So it'd be nice to get a question about how to issue currency in my classroom.
Where do we go for job ads, and when is the job close?
Oh, that's good. It's first weekend of December. It's available on the Joe, JOE, and our website, our human resources website.